He wished he'd had the sense to ask the grandmother a few questions. The old woman might have been sent to tell him the truth. When Hiram and Bobby Lee came back, they found Railroad leaning under the hood of the car.
"What we do now, boss?" Bobby Lee asked.
"Police could be here any minute," Hiram said.
Blood was smeared on the leg of his khaki pants.
"Somebody might have heard the shots."
Railroad pulled himself out from under the hood.
"The only thing we got to worry about now, Hiram, is how we get this radiator stopped leaking. You find a tire iron and straighten out this here fan. Bobby Lee, you get the belt off in the other car."
It took longer than the half hour Hiram had estimated to get the people's Studebaker back on the road. By the time they did, it was twilight, and the red dirt road was cast in the shadows of the pine woods. They pushed the stolen Hudson they'd been driving off into the trees and got into the Studebaker. Railroad gripped the wheel of the car, and they bounced down the dirt road toward the main highway. Hat pushed back on his head. Hiram went through the dead man's wallet. While in the back seat, Bobby Lee had the cat on his lap and was scratching it under the chin.
"Kitty, kitty, 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 kitty," he murmured.
$68, Hiram said. "With a 22 from the wife's purse, that makes 90 bucks.
He turned around and handed a wad of bills to Bobby Lee.
"Get rid of that damn cat," he said. "Want me to hold yours for you?"
he asked Railroad. Railroad reached over, took the bills, and stuffed them into the pocket of the yellow shirt with bright blue parrots that had belonged to the husband who'd been driving the car. Bailey Boy, the grandmother had called him. Railroad's shoulder twinged. The car shuddered. The wheels had been knocked out of kilter when it rolled. If he tried pushing past 50, it would shake itself right off the road. Railroad felt the warm weight of his pistol inside his belt, against his belly. Bobby Lee hummed tunelessly in the back seat. Hiram was quiet, fidgeting, looking out at the dark trees. He tugged his battered coat out of the vent window, tried to shake some of the wrinkles out of it.
"You oughtn't to use a man's coat without saying to him," he grumbled.
Bobby Lee spoke up.
"He didn't want the cat to get away."
Hiram sneezed.
"Will you throw that damn animal out the damn window?"
"She never hurt you none," Bobby Lee said.
Railroad said nothing. He had always imagined that the world was slightly unreal, that he was meant to be the citizen of some other place. His mind was a box. Outside the box was that world of distraction, amusement, annoyance. Inside the box, his real life went on, the struggle between what he knew and what he didn't know. He had a way of acting, polite, detached, because that way he wouldn't be bothered. When he was bothered, he got mad. When he got mad, bad things happened. He had always been prey to remorse, but now he felt it more fully than he had since he was a boy. He hadn't paid enough attention. He'd pegged the old lady as a hypocrite and had gone back into his box, thinking her just another fool from that puppet world. But that moment of her touching him, she'd wanted to comfort him, and he shot her. What was it the old woman had said?
"You could be honest if you'd only try. Think how wonderful it would be to settle down and live a comfortable life and not have to think about somebody chasing you all the time."
He knew she was only saying that to save her life, but that didn't mean it couldn't also be a message. Outside the box, Hiram asked,
"What was all that yammer-yammer with the grandmother about Jesus? We doing all the killing while you yammer-yammer?"
"He did shoot the old lady," Bobby Lee said.
"And made us carry her off to the woods, when if he'd have waited, she could have walked there like the others. We're the ones get blood on our clothes."
Railroad said quietly,
"You don't like the way things are going, son?"
Hiram twitched against the seat, like he was itchy between the shoulder blades.
"I ain't saying that. I just want out of this state."
"We're going to Atlanta. In Atlanta, we can get lost."
"Gonna give me a girl," Bobby Lee said.
"They got more cops in Atlanta than the rest of the state put together," Hiram said. "In Florida."
Without taking his eyes off the road, Railroad snapped his right hand across the bridge of Hiram's nose. Hiram jerked, more startled than hurt, and his hat tumbled off into the back seat. Bobby Lee laughed and handed Hiram his hat. It was after 11 when they hit the outskirts of Atlanta. Railroad pulled into a diner, the Sweet Spot, Red brick and an asbestos shingled roof, the air smelling of cigarettes and pork barbecue. Hiram rubbed some dirt from the lot into the stain on his pants leg. Railroad unlocked the trunk and found the dead man's suitcase, full of clothes. He carried it in with him. On the radio, sitting on the shelf behind the counter, Kitty Wells sang, "It Wasn't God Who Made Honky-Tonk Angels." Railroad studied the menu, front and back, and ordered biscuits and gravy. While they ate, Bobby Lee ran on about girls, and Hiram sat sullenly smoking. Railroad could tell Hiram was getting ready to do something stupid. He didn't need either of them anymore. So after they finished eating, Railroad left the car keys on the table and took the suitcase into the men's room. He locked the door. He pulled his .38 out of the waistband, put it on the sink, and changed out of the too tight dungarees into some of the dead husband's baggy trousers. He washed his face and hands. He cleaned his glasses on the tail of the parrot shirt, then tucked in the shirt. He stuck the .38 into the suitcase and came out again. Bobby Lee and Hiram were gone, and the car was no longer in the parking lot. The bill on the table, next to Hiram's still smoldering cigarette, was for $6.80. Railroad sat in the booth drinking his coffee. In the window of the diner, near the door, a piece of cardboard had been taped up saying, "Wanted, fry cook." When he was done with the coffee, he untaped the sign and headed to the register. After he paid the bill, he handed the cashier the sign. "I'm your man," he said. The cashier called the manager.
"Mr. Cawthron, this man says he's a cook."
Mr. Cawthron was maybe 35 years old. His carrot-red hair stood up in a pompadour like a rooster's comb, and a little belly swelled out over his belt.
"What's your name?"
"Lloyd Bailey."
"Lloyd, what experience do you have?"
"I can cook anything on this here menu," Railroad said. The manager took him back to the kitchen.
"Stand aside, Shorty,"
the manager said to the tall black man at the grill.
"Fix me a Denver omelet," he said to Railroad.
Railroad washed his hands, put on an apron, broke two eggs into a bowl. He threw handfuls of chopped onion, green pepper, and diced ham into a skillet. When the onions were soft, he poured the beaten eggs over the ham and vegetables, added salt and cayenne pepper. When he slid the finished omelet onto a plate, the manager bent down over it, as if he were inspecting the paint job on a used car. He straightened up.
"Pays $30 a week. Be here at 6 in the morning.
Out in the lot, Railroad set down his bag and looked around. Cicadas buzzed in the hot city night. Around the corner from the diner, he'd noticed a big Victorian house with a sign on the porch, "Rooms for Rent." He was about to start walking when, out of the corner of his eye, he caught a movement by the trash barrel next to the chain-link fence. He peered into the gloom and saw the cat trying to leap up to the top to get at the garbage. He went over, held out his hand. The cat didn't run. It sniffed him, butted its head against his hand. He picked it up, cradled it under his arm, and carried it in the bag to the rooming house. Under dense oaks, it was a big, tan, clapboard mansion with green shutters and hanging baskets of begonias on the porch, and a green porch swing. The thick oval leaded glass of the oak door was beveled around the edge, the brass of the handle dark with age. The door was unlocked. His heart jumped a bit at the opportunity it presented. At the same time, he wanted to warn the proprietor against such foolishness. Off to one side of the entrance was a little table with a doily, vase, and dried flowers. On the other, a sign beside the door said, "Manager." Railroad knocked. After a moment, the door opened, and a woman with the face of an angel opened it. She was not young, perhaps 40, with very white skin and blonde hair. She looked at him, smiled, saw the cat under his arm.
"What a sweet animal," she said.
"I like a room," he said.
"I'm sorry, we don't cater to pets,"
the woman said, not unkindly. "This here's no pet, ma'am," Railroad said. "This here's my only friend in the world." The landlady's name was Mrs. Graves. The room she rented him was 12 feet by 12 feet, with a single bed, a cherry veneer dresser, a wooden table and chair, a narrow closet, lace curtains on the window, and an old pineapple quilt on the bed. The air smelled sweet. On the wall opposite the bed was a picture in a dime store frame, of an empty rowboat floating in an angry gray ocean, the sky overcast.
Only a single shaft of sunlight in the distance from a sunset that was not in the picture.
The room cost $10 a week. Despite Mrs. Graves' rule against pets, like magic she took a shine to Railroad's cat. It was almost as if she'd rented the room to the cat, with Railroad along for the ride. After some consideration, he named the cat Pleasure. She was the most affectionate animal he had ever seen. She wanted to be with him, even when he ignored her. She made him feel wanted. She made him nervous. Railroad fashioned a cat door in the window of his room, so that Pleasure could go out and in whenever she wanted, and not be confined to the room when Railroad was at work. The only other residents of the boarding house were Louise Parker, a schoolteacher, and Charles Foster, a lingerie salesman. Mrs. Graves cleaned Railroad's room once a week, swept the floors, alternated the quilt every other week, with a second one done in a rose pattern that he remembered from his childhood. He worked at the diner from 6 in the morning, when Macy, the cashier, unlocked, until Shorty took over at 3 in the afternoon. The counter girl was Betsy, and service a Negro boy, bus tables and wash dishes. Railroad told them to call him Bailey, and didn't talk much. When he wasn't working, Railroad spent most of his time at the boarding house, or evenings in a small nearby park. Railroad would take the Bible from the drawer in the boarding house table, buy an afternoon newspaper, and carry them with him. Pleasure often followed him to the park. She would lunge after squirrels and shy away from dogs, hissing sideways. Cats liked to kill squirrels. Dogs liked to kill cats. But there was no sin in it. Pleasure would not go to hell or heaven. Cats had no souls. The world was full of stupid people like Bobby Lee and Hiram, who lied to themselves and killed without knowing why. Life was a prison. Turn to the right, it was a wall. Turn to the left, it was a wall. Look up, it was a ceiling. Look down, it was a floor. And Railroad had taken out his imprisonment on others. He was not deceived in his own behavior. Railroad did not believe in sin, but somehow he felt it. Still, he was not a dog or a cat. He was a man. You're one of my own children. There was no reason why he had to kill people. He only wished he'd never have to deal with any Hirams and Bobby Lees anymore. He gazed across the park at the Ipana toothpaste sign painted on the wall of the Piggly Wiggly. Whiter than white. Pleasure crouched at the end of the bench, her haunches twitching as she watched a finch hop across the sidewalk. Railroad picked her up, rubbed his cheek against her whiskers. Pleasure, I'll tell you what, he whispered. Let's make us a deal. You save me from Bobby Lee and Hiram, and I'll never kill anybody again. The cat looked at him with its clear yellow eyes. Railroad sighed. He put the cat down. He leaned back on the bench and opened the newspaper. Beneath the fold on the front page, he read, Escaped convicts killed in wreck. Valdosta. Two escaped convicts and an unidentified female passenger were killed Tuesday when the late model stolen automobile they were driving struck a bridge abutment while being pursued by state police. The deceased convicts, Hiram Leroy Burgett, 31, and Bobby Lee Ross, 21, escaped June 23rd while being transported to the state hospital for the criminally insane for psychological evaluation. A third escapee, Ronald Ruel Pickens, 47, is still at large. The lunch rush was petering out. There were 2 people at the counter, and 4 booths were occupied, and Railroad had set a BLT and an order of fried chicken with collards up on the shelf when Macy came back into the kitchen and called the manager.
Police want to talk to you, Mr. C.
Railroad peeked out from behind the row of hanging order slips. A man in a suit sat at the counter, sipping sweet tea. Cawthron went out to talk to him.
2 castaways on a raft.
Betsy called to Railroad. The man spoke with Cawthron for a few minutes, showed him a photograph. Cawthron shook his head, nodded, shook his head again. They laughed. Railroad eyed the back door of the diner, but turned back to the grill. By the time he had the toast up and the eggs fried, the man was gone. Cawthron stepped back to his office without saying anything. At the end of the shift, he pulled Railroad aside.
Floyd, he said. I need to speak with you.
Railroad followed him into the cubbyhole he called his office.
Cawthron sat behind the cluttered metal desk and picked up a letter from the top layer of trash.
I just got this here note from Social Security saying that number you gave is not valid.
He looked up at Railroad, his china blue eyes unreadable. Railroad took off his glasses and rubbed the bridge of his nose with his thumb and forefinger. He didn't say anything.
I suppose it's just some mix-up, Cawthron said. Same as that business with the detective this afternoon. Don't you worry about it.
Thank you, Mr. Cawthron.
One other thing, before you go, Lloyd. Did I say your salary was 30 a week? I meant 25. That okay with you?
Whatever you say, Mr. Cawthron.
And I think in order to encourage trade, we'll start opening at 5. I'd like you to pick up the extra hour, starting Monday.
Railroad nodded. Is that all?
That's it, Lloyd.
Cawthron seemed suddenly to enjoy calling Railroad Lloyd, rolling the name over his tongue and watching for his reaction.
Thanks for being such a Christian employee.
Railroad went back to his room in the rooming house. Pleasure mewed for him, and when he sat on the bed, hopped into his lap. But Railroad just stared at the picture of the rowboat on the opposite wall. After a while, the cat hopped onto the windowsill and out through her door onto the roof. Only a crazy person would use the knowledge that a man was a murderer in order to cheat that man out of his pay. How could he know that Railroad wouldn't kill him, or run away, or do both? Lucky for Cawthron that Railroad had made his deal with Pleasure. But now he didn't know what to do. If the old lady's message was from God, then maybe this was his first test. Nobody said being good was supposed to be easy. Nobody said, just because Railroad was turning to good, everybody he met forever after would be good. Railroad had asked Pleasure to save him from Bobby Lee and Hiram, not Mr. Cawthron. He needed guidance. He slid open the drawer of the table. Beside the Bible was his .38. He flipped open the cylinder, checked to see that all the chambers were loaded, then put it back into the drawer. He took out the Bible and opened it at random. The first verse his eyes fell on was from Deuteronomy. These you may eat of all that are in the waters. You may eat all that have fins and scales, and whatever does not have fins and scales, you shall not eat. There was a knock at the door. Railroad looked up. Yes?
Mr. Bailey?
It was Mrs. Graves.
I thought you might like some tea.
Keeping his finger in the Bible to mark his page, Railroad got up and opened the door. Mrs. Graves stood there with a couple of tall glasses, beaded with sweat, on a tray.
That's mighty kind of you, Miss Graves. Would you like to come in?
Thank you, Mr. Bailey.
She set the tray down on the table, gave him a glass. It was like nectar.
Is it sweet enough?
It's perfect, ma'am. She wore a yellow print dress with little flowers on it. Her every movement showed a calm he had not seen in a woman before. And her gray eyes exuded compassion, as if to say, I know who you are, but that doesn't matter. They sat down, he on the bed, she on the chair. She saw the Bible in his hand.
I find many words of comfort in the Bible.
I can't say I find much comfort in it, ma'am. Too many bloody deeds.
But many acts of goodness.
You said a true word.
Sometimes I wish I could live in the world of goodness, she smiled. But this world is good enough. Did she really think that?
Since Eve ate the apple, ma'am, it's a world of good and evil. How can goodness make up for the bad? That's a mystery to me.
She sipped her tea.
Of course it's a mystery. That's the point.
The point is, something's always after you, deserve it or not.
What a sad thought, Mr. Bailey.
Yes'm. From minute to minute we fade away. The only way to get to heaven is to die.
After Mrs. Graves left, he sat thinking about her beautiful face. Like an angel. Nice titties, too. And yet he didn't even want to rape her. He would marry her. He would settle down, like the grandmother said. But he would have to get an engagement ring. If he'd been thinking, he could have taken the grandmother's ring. But how was he supposed to know when he'd killed her that he was going to fall in love so soon? He opened the dresser, felt among the dead man's clothes until he found the sock, pulled out his savings. It was only $43. The only help for it was to ask Pleasure. Railroad paced the room. It was a long time, and Railroad began to worry before the cat came back. The cat slipped silently through her door, lay down on the table, simple as you please, in the wedge of sunlight coming in the window. Railroad got down on his knees, his face level with the tabletop. The cat went,
"Huh?"
and raised its head. Railroad gazed into her steady eyes.
"Pleasure," he said. "I need to get an engagement ring, and I don't have enough money. Get one for me."
The cat watched him. He waited for some sign. Nothing happened. Then, like a dam bursting, a flood of confidence flowed into him. He knew what he would do. The next morning, he walked down to the sweet spot, whistling. He spent much of his shift imagining when and how he would ask Mrs. Graves for her hand. Maybe on the porch swing, on Saturday night, or at breakfast some morning. He could leave the ring next to his plate and she would find it, with his note, when clearing the table. Or he could come down to her room in the middle of the night, and he'd ram himself into her in the darkness, make her whimper, then lay the perfect diamond on her breast. At the end of the shift, he took a beefsteak from the diner's refrigerator as an offering to pleasure. But when he entered his room, the cat was not there. He left the meat wrapped in butcher paper in the kitchen downstairs, then went back up and changed into Bailey Boy's baggy suit. At the corner, he took the bus downtown and walked into the first jewelry store he saw. He made the woman show him several diamond engagement rings. Then the phone rang, and when the woman went to answer it, he pocketed a ring and walked out. No clerk in her right mind should be so careless, but it went exactly as he had imagined it, as easy as breathing. That night he had a dream. He was alone with Mrs. Graves, and she was making love to him, but as he moved against her, he felt the skin of her full breast deflate and wrinkle beneath his hand, and he found he was making love to the dead grandmother, her face grinning, the same vacant grin it had when Hiram and Bobby Lee hauled her into the woods. Railroad woke in terror. Pleasure was sitting on his chest, her face an inch from his, purring loud as a diesel. He snatched the cat up in both hands and hurled her across the room. She hit the wall with a thump, then fell to the floor, claws skittering on the hard wood. She scuttled for the window, through the door onto the porch roof. It took him 10 minutes for his heart to slow down, and then he could not sleep. Someone is always after you. That day in the diner, when Railroad was taking a break, sitting on a stool in front of the window fan sipping some ice water, Cawthron came out of the office and put his hand on his shoulder, the one that still hurt occasionally.
"Hot work, ain't it, boy?"
"Yes, sir." Railroad was 10 or 12 years older than Cawthron.
"What is this world coming to?"
Macy said to nobody in particular. She had the newspaper open on the counter and was scanning the headlines.
"You read what it says here about some man robbing a diamond ring right out from under the nose of the clerk at Miriam's Jewelry."
"I saw that already," Mr. Cawthron said. And after a moment, "White fella, wasn't it?"
"It was,"
sighed Macy.
"Must be some trash from the backwoods. Some of those poor people have not had the benefit of a Christian upbringing."
"They'll catch 'em. Men like that always get caught."
Cawthron leaned in the doorway of his office, arms crossed above his belly.
"Macy," Cawthron said, "did I tell you Lloyd here is the best short-order cook we've had here since 1947? The best white short-order cook."
"I heard you say that."
"I mean, makes you wonder where he was before he came here. Was he short-order cooking all around Atlanta? Seems like we would have heard, don't it? Come to think, Lloyd never told me much about where he was before he showed up that day. He ever say much to you, Macy?"
"Can't say as I recall."
"You can't recall because he hasn't. What you say, Lloyd? Why is that?"
"No time for conversation, Mr. Cawthron."
"No time for conversation? You carrying some resentment, Lloyd? We ain't paying you enough?"
"I didn't say that.
Because, if you don't like it here, I'd be unhappy to lose the best white short-order cook I had since 1947.
Railroad put down his empty glass and slipped on his paper hat. "I can't afford to lose this job. And you don't mind my saying, Mr. Cawthron, you'd come to regret it if I was forced to leave."
"Weren't you listening, Lloyd? Isn't that what I just said?"
"Yes, you did. And maybe we ought to quit bothering Macy with our talk and get back to work."
"I like a man that enjoys his job,"
Cawthron said, slapping Railroad on the shoulder again.
"I'd have to be suicidal to make a good worker like you leave. Do I look suicidal, Lloyd?"
No, you don't look suicidal, Mr. Cawthorn.
I see pleasure all the time going down the block to pick at the trash by the sweet spot,
Mrs. Graves told him as they sat on the front porch swing that evening.
That cat could get hurt if you let it out so much. That is a busy street.
Foster had gone to a ball game, and Louise Parker was visiting her sister in Chattanooga, so they were alone. It was the opportunity Railroad had been waiting for. I don't want to keep her a prisoner, he said. The chain on the swing creaked as they rocked slowly back and forth. He could smell her lilac perfume. The curve of her thigh beneath her print dress caught the light from the front room coming through the window.
You're a man who has spent much time alone, aren't you? She said. So mysterious.
He had his hand in his pocket, the ring in his fingers. He hesitated. A couple walking down the sidewalk nodded at them. He couldn't do it out here, where the world might see. Mrs. Graves, would you come up to my room? I have something I need to show you. She did not hesitate.
I hope there's nothing wrong.
No, ma'am. Just something I'd like to rearrange. He opened the door for her and followed her up the stairs. The clock in the hall ticked loudly. He opened the door to his room and ushered her in, closed the door behind them. When she turned to face him, he fell to his knees. He held up the ring in both hands, his offering. Miss Graves, I want you to marry me. She looked at him kindly, her expression calm. The silence stretched. She reached out. He thought she was going to take the ring, but instead she touched his wrist.
I can't marry you, Mr. Bailey.
Why not?
Why, I hardly know you.
Railroad felt dizzy. You could sometime.
I'll never marry again, Mr. Bailey. It's not you.
Not him. It was never him. Had never been him. His knees hurt from the hardwood floor. He looked at the ring, lowered his hands, clasped it in his fist. She moved her hand from his wrist to his shoulder, squeezed it. A knife of pain ran down his arm. Without standing, he punched Mrs. Graves in the stomach. She gasped and fell back onto the bed. He was on her in a second, one hand over her mouth, while he ripped her dress open from the neck. She struggled, and he pulled the pistol out from behind his back and held it to her head. She lay still. Don't you stop me now, he muttered. He tugged his pants down and did what he wanted. How ladylike it was of her to keep so silent. Much later, lying on the bed, eyes dreamily focused on the light fixture in the center of the ceiling, it came to him what had bothered him about the grandmother. She had ignored the fact that she was going to die. She would have been a good woman if it had been somebody there to shoot her every minute of her life, he told Bobby Lee, and that was true. But then, for that last moment, she became a good woman. The reason was that, once Railroad convinced her she was going to die, she could forget about it. In the end, when she reached out to him, there was no thought in her mind about death, about the fact that he had killed her son and daughter-in-law and grandchildren, and was soon going to kill her. All she wanted was to comfort him. She didn't even care if he couldn't be comforted. She was living in that exact instant, with no memory of the past or regard for the future, out of the instinct of her soul and nothing else. Like the cat. Pleasure lived that way all the time. The cat didn't know about Jesus' sacrifice, about angels and devils. That cat looked at him and saw what was there. He raised himself on his elbows. Mrs. Graves lay very still beside him, her blonde hair spread across the pineapple quilt. He felt her neck for a pulse. It was dark night now. The whine of insects in the oaks outside the window, the rush of traffic on the cross street, drifted in on the hot air. Quietly, Railroad slipped out into the hall and down to Foster's room. He put his ear to the door and heard no sound. He came back to his own room, wrapped Mrs. Graves in the quilt, and as silently as he could, dragged her into his closet. He closed the door. Railroad heard purring and saw Pleasure sitting on the table, watching. God damn you. God damn you to hell, he said to the cat. But before he could grab her, the calico had darted out the window. He figured it out. The idea of marrying Mrs. Graves had been only a stage in the subtle revenge being taken on him by the dead grandmother through the cat.
The wishes pleasure had granted were the bait. The nightmare had been a warning, but he hadn't listened. He rubbed his sore shoulder. The old lady's gesture, like a mustard seed, had grown to be a great crow-filled tree in Railroad's heart. A good trick the devil had played on him. Now, no matter how he reformed himself, he could not get rid of what he had done. It was hot and still, not a breath of air, as if the world were being smothered in a fever blanket. A milk-white sky. The kitchen of the sweet spot was hot as the furnace of hell. Beneath his shirt, Railroad sweat ran down to slick the warm pistol slit into his belt. Railroad was fixing a stack of buttermilk pancakes when the detective walked in. The detective walked over to the counter and sat down on one of the stools. Macy was not at the counter. She was probably in the ladies' room. The detective took a look around, then plucked a menu from behind the napkin holder in front of him and started reading. On the radio, Hank Williams was singing, "I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry." Quietly, Railroad untied his apron and slipped out of the back door. In the alley near the trash barrels, he looked out over the lot. He was about to hop the chain-link fence when he saw Cawthron's car stopped at the light on the corner. Railroad pulled out his pistol, crouched behind a barrel, and aimed at the space in the lot where Cawthron usually parked. He felt something bump against his leg. It was pleasure. "Don't you cross me now," Railroad whispered, pushing the animal away. The cat came back, put her front paws up on his thigh, purring. "Damn you! You owe me, you little demon," he hissed. He let the gun drop, looked down at the cat. Pleasure looked up at him.
"Meow."
"What do you want? You want me to stop, do you? Then make it go away. Make it so I never kill nobody."
Nothing happened. It was just a fucking animal. In a rage, he dropped the gun and seized the cat in both hands. She twisted in his grasp, hissing.
"You know what it's like to hurt in your heart?"
Railroad tore open his shirt and pressed Pleasure against his chest.
"Feel it. Feel it beating there."
Pleasure squirmed and clawed, hatching his chest with a web of scratches.
"You owe me. You owe me."
Railroad was shouting now.
"Make it go away."
Pleasure finally twisted out of his grasp. The cat fell, rolled, and scurried away, running right under Cawthron's car as it pulled into the lot. With a little bump, the car's left front tire ran over her. Cawthron jerked the car to a halt. Pleasure howled, still alive, writhing, trying to drag herself away on her front paws. Her back was broken. Railroad looked at the fence, looked back. He ran over to Pleasure and knelt down. Cawthron got out of the car. Railroad tried to pick up the cat, but she hissed and bit him. Her sides fluttered with rapid breathing. Her eyes clouded. She rested her head on the gravel. Railroad had trouble breathing. He looked up from his crouch to see that Macy and some customers had come out of the diner. Among them was the detective.
"I didn't mean to do that, Lloyd," Cawthron said. "It just ran out in front of me."
He paused a moment.
"Jesus Christ, Lloyd. What happened to your chest?"
Railroad picked up the cat in his bloody hands.
"Nobody ever gets away with nothing," he said. "I'm ready to go now."
"Go where?"
"Back to prison."
"What are you talking about?"
"Me and Hiram and Bobby Lee killed all those folks in the woods and took their car. This was their cat."
"What people?"
"Bailey Boy and his mother and his wife and his kids and his baby."
The detective pushed back his hat and scratched his head.
"You all best come in here and we'll talk this thing over."
They went into the diner. Railroad would not let them take Pleasure from him until they gave him a corrugated cardboard box to put the body in. Macy brought him a towel to wipe his hands, and Railroad told the detective, whose name was Vernon Scott Shaw, all about the state hospital for the criminally insane, and the hearse-like Hudson, and the family they'd murdered in the backwoods. Mostly he talked about the grandmother and the cat. Shaw sat there and listened soberly. At the end, he folded up his notebook and said,
"That's quite a story, Mr. Bailey. But we caught the people who did that killing.
And it ain't you."
"What do you mean? I know what I done."
"Another thing, you don't think I'd know if there was some murderer loose from the penitentiary?"
"There isn't anyone escaped." What were you doing in here last week? Asking questions.
I was having myself some pancakes and coffee.
I didn't make this up.
So you say. But seems to me, Mr. Bailey, you've been standing over a hot stove too long.
Railroad didn't say anything. He felt as if his heart was about to break.
Mr. Cawthron told him he might just as well take the morning off and get some rest. He would man the griddle himself.
Railroad got unsteadily to his feet, took the box containing Pleasure's body, and tucked it under his arm. He walked out of the diner. He went back to the boarding house. He climbed the steps. Mr. Foster was in the front room reading the newspaper.
"Morning, Bailey," he said. "What you got there?"
"My cat got killed."
"No. Sorry to hear that."
"You seen Miss Graves this morning?" he asked.
"Not yet."
Railroad climbed the stairs, walked slowly down the hall to his room. He entered. Dust motes danced in the sunlight coming through the window. The ocean rowboat was no darker than it had been the day before. He set the dead cat down next to the Bible on the table. The pineapple quilt was no longer on the bed. Now it was the rose. He reached into his pocket and felt the engagement ring. The closet door was closed. He went to it, put his hand on the doorknob. He turned it and opened the door. Candia. Graham Joyce.
Graham Joyce is the author of 16 novels and a collection of short stories. He won the World Fantasy Award for his novel The Facts of Life, and has won the British Fantasy Award for Best Novel an unprecedented 5 times. His work has been translated into more than 20 languages. In 2009, he was awarded the O. Henry Prize for his short story, An Ordinary Soldier of the Queen. He is currently working on the computer game Doom 4. Joyce says, "While I was still trying to get published as a writer, I lived on the Greek islands for a while, and I spent 6 months in Chania on the west of Crete. It had been under Ottoman rule for some centuries, when the name of the town was Candia. While I was there, someone led me to a strange nightclub behind the old spice warehouses on the seafront. The person who took me there left the island suddenly, and I was never able to find the place again. At the place where I thought it should be, an empty building was home to a number of feral cats, and that last detail was what triggered the story."
Candia. It was surely in Candia, with its crumbling Venetian waterfront, and its abandoned minarets, and its harbor sliding into the rose-colored sea further by an inch every day. Just like Ben Wheeler when I first spotted him, with his bottle of raki at his permanent station outside the Black Orchid Café, a misted tumbler forever fixed at some point on the arc between tabletop and bottom lip. I had just climbed down from the rusting, antiquated bus, the sole passenger to disembark in that dusty square, when I saw him, at a time when I never expected to see anyone again I'd ever known. His glass of raki attested itself on its mechanical ascent, and he peered across the rim of his tumbler directly into my eyes. He was sitting at a table on the concrete edge of the neglected wharf. Over his shoulder the sun was punctured on a derelict minaret, spilling lavender and molten gold across the motionless waters of the harbor. He took a sip from his glass and turned away.
"Wheeler," I called. "Hey, Wheeler."
On hearing his name, he spun round and looked at me again, this time with an expression of incredulity and horror. Then he looked around wildly, as if for egress. For a moment, I thought he was actually going to make a break for it and run away from me. I crossed the square to the cafe and dragged a seat from under the table, but he showed no sign that he would allow me to join him. I was made to hover. "Don't you remember me?" I asked. Before I got an answer, a singer struck up in the square. He had a cardboard shoebox for donations, and was singing in that curious, deep-throated and unaccompanied recitica of the dispossessed people from the mountains. The sound was of almost unendurable melancholy and sweetness, and the guttural voice resonated along the baked brickwork. Wheeler put down his glass and hooked his thumbs in his waistband. regarding me with an unblinking gaze. I wasn't fooled. He was clearly nervous. It was as if he had somewhere important to go, but in his astonishment at seeing me there, he couldn't tear himself away. "So, what are you doing here?" I asked. He eyed me steadily. "I might ask you the same question." He looked back at the square and stroked the white stubble of his beard. Again, I got the impression I was detaining him for something important. "I've come here to drink myself to death," I joked. At least it was a truth hidden inside a joke. But he nodded seriously, as if this was perfectly reasonable. The arrival of a waiter brought a moment's relief. Slow to spot him, Wheeler turned suddenly and fixed the waiter with his extraordinary gaze. The boy shuffled uncomfortably, tapping the steel disc of his tray against his thigh. "Let me stand you a drink," I suggested. Wheeler put his hand to his mouth, removing something very small from the tip of his tongue. "Sure," he let his eyes drop. "Sit down. I'll have a beer. Yes, I'll have a beer." I sat, but I was already beginning to regret this. Ben Wheeler looked terrible. I could see a ring of filth on the collar of his short-sleeved shirt. The hems of his oil-spotted chinos were rolled, and his bare feet were thrust inside a pair of rotting, rope-soled espadrilles. When the beer arrived, he slurped it greedily. We sat in a stiff silence for a while, the swelling vocalizations of the Resitica man the only other sound in the square, in the parched heat of the afternoon. Our paths had crossed briefly in the 80s, when we were both working for Aid Direct, the notorious London-based charity, 3 or 4 years before public scandal closed the outfit down. Wheeler, director of fundraising at the time, was a flamboyant character in a double-breasted suit and 60s haircut that looked like it was woven out of brown twill. For some of the serious-minded charity workers, he was too fond of champagne, parties, and pretty girls. But he could bring in money the way a poacher can tickle trout from a stream. The 80s. New money wanted to log onto charitable causes, not out of any sense of philanthropy, but to clamber aboard the Queen's Honours List. Wheeler obliged by organizing fat cat charity parties, in which city stockbrokers and dealers would be photographed sipping champers from a page 3 girl's shoe, all before writing a check. After one of these all-night jamborees at the Savoy or the Dorchester, a sack of rice or two would end up on a truck bound for Ethiopia or Somalia. At the time, I didn't care where the money came from, or how little of it found a way through, so long as it assisted me in my plans to change the world. Or rather, I wasn't so naive as to believe one could change the world, but I did believe it was possible to change one person's world, and that was good enough for me. I'd only been working for Aid Direct about 6 months before accountants were called in. No one was ever told why, but Wheeler was suddenly given an impressive golden handshake. After the farewell party, I got caught in the lift with him. He was smashed. "Hey," he said that day, "something I want to do, before I leave here." "What?" I said, my finger hovering over the lift button. He swayed dangerously. "Young tart who works in your office. What's name? Catlight. Yum yum. Feline." I offered no help, and he supplied the name himself. Sarah. "What about her?" The lift started its descent. "Before I go, 10 minutes with Sarah the feline, in the store cupboard. Hey, 10 minutes. Good luck." "No, no," he said, brushing imaginary lint from the front of my jacket. "I want you to ask her for me. Get out of here." The lift door opened. His huge, manicured hand restrained me as I made to step out of the lift. Fumbling in his pocket, he produced a couple of banknotes and stuffed them in my breast pocket. "Ask her." "Piss off." More banknotes, stuffed in with the others. "Ask her for me." Still more. Big denomination. "Just ask her for me." He patted my cheek with his beringed paw. We got out of the lift and I went back to my office, where Sarah was audiotyping. With her lithe figure and her long raven hair scraped back from her face and tied at the back, Sarah cut a figure like a ballerina. Who wouldn't want 10 minutes with Sarah? I did. I'd taken her out a few times. Despite some lavish wining and dining, she resisted all my best efforts. Any man who has tried and failed to seduce a particular woman nurses a tiny malice, and I confess to giving way to disgraceful and sadistic instinct to collude with Wheeler's drunken lust. I gently lifted one of her earphones. We need some more envelopes. Can you go get them?
Now?
Please.
What's the rush?
She looked at me quizzically and I turned my back. I heard her replacing her headset on the table. The door closed as she went out. Half an hour later she was back, flushed and looking like she'd learned some new wrestling holds. I caught her eye, but I was the one to look away first. The expression of guilt, shame and humiliation on Sarah's face filled me with self-loathing and regret. She put her headset back on and resumed work, punching so hard on her keyboard I thought it might shatter. It disgusted me that Wheeler had found it so easy to make a whore out of a perfectly respectable young woman, and a pimp out of me. As for the money he stuffed into my breast pocket, I can't even bring myself to repeat how little it was. I only hope Sarah got a lot more. I waited until Sarah left the office. I heard her heels clacking angrily on the linoleum of the corridor. That was the last time I'd seen Wheeler. 10 or more years had gone by. Now here he was, washed up in Candia, his face crumbling like a waterfront warehouse, and with eyes like the oil-slicked, scummy backwash of the sea. Did he remember that episode in the lift on his last day at Aid Direct? I doubted it. But then people choose not to remember things. Or they pretend to forget. He put his fingers to his mouth again, plucking from his tongue what I thought was a loose strand of tobacco. Finessing it clear of his fingers, he drained his glass. "Have another," I offered. My companionable behavior was more to do with my own intolerable loneliness than with any attraction in Wheeler's company. Besides, I was curious. He shook his head, didn't move. I signaled to the waiter, who brought another beer and a rakia for me. "You heard about the company after you left?" A light went on.
"You worked at AD. That must be where I know you from."
"Recall the episode with Sarah?" He barely remembered me. I reintroduced myself. "William Blythe. I was in the training department."
"Yes, yes, yes, I remember."
Again his hand went to his mouth. "What did you do after that? After Aid Direct, I mean."
"Went here. Went there. Here. There."
It was dark by now. The Resetika singer had gone, carrying away his shoebox without a single donation. A breeze picked up off the swelling black tide, and Wheeler shivered. The water sucked and slopped around the concrete breakers. Laughter carried across the bay from one of the bars, making him look over his shoulder. I guessed he was hungry. "I'm just going to eat," I said. We went to a small restaurant converted from a spice warehouse in the narrow streets behind the waterfront. I ordered an array of small dishes and Wheeler fell on them like a man who hadn't eaten in days. After a few glasses of resonated wine, he began to drop his guard. "How long have you lived here?" I asked.
"Some years. 4, maybe. Not sure anymore."
"How do you survive?" He drained his glass and looked at me quite sincerely.
"I don't know. I don't do anything. One day runs into another. I'm always hungry, but I survive. And I don't know how."
He became distracted, gazing at something across my shoulder. Then his fingers went to his mouth again, unconsciously plucking something from the tip of his tongue before flicking it to the floor. He looked up at me with a sudden intensity. "Have you ever tried to leave this town?" The question was absurd. I'd only just arrived. It's not hard. Tourist buses come in and out every day in the summer months. He laughed cynically.
"Sure, but I'm no tourist, and neither are you. Tell me, where were you before you came here?"
I tried to think, but my mind went blank. He found this amusing. He laughed again and seemed to relax. He returned to his food, and then he did something I haven't seen anyone do in a long time. He picked up an almost empty plate and he licked the sauce clean with his tongue.
"Terrific food here," he said. "What was in that sauce?"
"Knowing this place," I joked, "it was probably a dead cat." That was the wrong thing to say. Wheeler carefully set down his plate and pushed it away from him, staring at the dish as if it was on fire. I broke his trance by asking him where he stayed. He looked confused.
"Anywhere. Anywhere they let me stay.
Now I have to go. Don't, I said. Have another drink. Look, it's my birthday. It was true, and though Wheeler wasn't first choice for company, I was feeling sorry for myself. The popping of a celebration cork is a lonely sound when you're on your own. Wheeler looked astonished. You're lying. Why should I lie? September 21st. It's my birthday. Wheeler stood up. But that means it's the autumnal equinox today. I shrugged. And you arrived here today. You don't understand. This could be an opportunity. Opportunity? If it really is your birthday, the Shades Club might be open. Shades? Where's that? You haven't been? I could take you there. I wasn't sure I wanted to go to the Shades Club, wherever it was, whatever it was, but Wheeler insisted. He became more interested in me than at any other point in the evening. But what else had I to do? I had no one to go home to, and nothing to detain me. I was ready to be picked up by any foul wind blowing in from the ocean. It was around midnight when I settled the bill at the restaurant. As we walked across the waterfront, sounds from one of the cafes drifted across the bay, another explosion of men's laughter, and the eerie, skirling music of the bow of a lira drawn across strings, as taut as a man's nerves on Judgment Day. Wheeler led me behind the crumbling waterfront and into the derelict streets of what was once spice warehouses in the grand trading days of Candia. Damp odors of ancient plaster, brine, spice, and exhausted trade breathed along the rat runs of those streets. Then Wheeler was clambering over a pile of broken bricks. He spotted my hesitation and beckoned me to follow. It was on my own birthday that I first discovered the Shade Club, he explained. He ducked under a fractured arch and I could see he was heading for the ruined mosque. The moon, obscured by the clouds, barely offered enough light to illuminate the needle of the minaret. In the glory of its trading days, Candia had prospered under 400 years of Ottoman rule, but the infidel had returned, and the dome of the mosque lay sundered, like a cracked egg laid by some giant mythical reptile. The minaret sailed defiantly above the moon-cast ruins, but the exotic call of the Adan was no more than a ghost. A clump of jasmine growing amongst the rubble breathed a tiger perfume into the night. I followed Wheeler through a fissure in the tumbled wall, and we emerged in a darkened street. A flight of stone steps descended behind the shadows of the mosque. The anapest beat of music thudded from below. At the bottom of the steps, a malfunctioning red neon light fizzed, spitting the words, Shades Club. The letter S flickered intermittently. The place was almost empty. Two women sat at the shadowy end of the bar, both stirring tall cocktail glasses with a straw, both displaying a lot of leg. It's a clip joint, I said to Wheeler, annoyed. The bar looked like any other place I'd been in where you pay for girls to sip colored water, and at prices that would frighten a steeplejack. No, it's not like that. Sit down, it'll be all right. I took a stool at the bar. An old-style jukebox was grinding out early rock music. Someone behind me was cleaning tables with a dirty rag. I saw the girls give us the once-over, but the sight of Wheeler made them lose interest. Wheeler surprised me by storming behind the bar and confidently mixing vodka martinis. I'm known here, he assured me. Knowing he was broke, I took out my wallet, but he waved it away. Don't worry, it's free. Overhearing, one of the girls snorted.
Free. He says it's free. Nothing is free.
The second of the two, the one who'd said nothing, was smiling at me, holding her cocktail glass to her mouth. The bar was lit by soft blue and ruby lights, and she struck me as extraordinarily pretty as she waited for me to come back at her friend's remark. Perhaps because Wheeler had reminded me of the incident, I was struck by how much she resembled Sarah from our days at Aid Direct. You're a philosopher, I said. Taking this as a rebuff, the outspoken one looked away, exhibiting the attributes of extreme boredom, but the other continued to gaze in my direction. You've made a hit, said Wheeler, coming from behind the bar. She's nice, I whispered. Wheeler nearly dropped his glass. You like her? You mean you really like her? I couldn't understand why he was so amazed. I checked her out again. Wheeler's response suggested he regarded her as some kind of reptile. Doesn't she remind you of... Wheeler was looking at me searchingly.
I decided to let it go. She's beautiful. And she was. At least so she seemed in shadow. Long auburn hair and a China doll complexion. Just a hint of the Oriental about her. Wheeler made some sort of gesture to her, because she got off her stool and came over. I got the chance to look at her in proper light. She was even more striking than my first impression had suggested. It was not until she came over that I realized the two women were wearing some kind of fancy dress outfits, leotards and sheer black nylon tights. Her eyes were heavily lined with mascara. Wheeler, in a state of some excitement, introduced us, and she slid onto the stool next to me.
"This is Lily,"
Wheeler said, and almost from behind his hand he added, "and I think I've found my way out of this town." I didn't know what he meant, and I didn't much like the way he said it. It reminded me of how little I trusted the man. I thought again of Aide Direct, and how after he'd gone the depth of his corruption had been made plain. The organization, heavily in debt, collapsed like a house of cards. The executives, those caring, sharing, liberal, bleeding-heart charity workers, began stripping the place before the liquidators came in. Office equipment was driven away by the van load. The carpool drained itself overnight, and fabulously inflated expenses were cash processed before the banks had wind of what was happening. My immediate superior stopped a consignment of rice before it left the docks and sold it on to a Whole Food Collective, pocketing the proceeds. I have to say that, demoralized, I joined in this feverish stampede. But I was too busy getting along fine with Lily to give much thought to Wheeler's odd remark. Lily and I sensed immediate rapport. I can't remember anything I said to her, or she to me, but we had anchored, and the next 15 minutes melted in a miraculous and sympathetic exchange of thoughts. It was only when I offered to buy her a drink that I noticed Wheeler deep in conversation with the other woman. They eyed me intently. I sensed that they were striking some kind of deal, and that it involved me. The jukebox went dead. Lily jumped up to feed it with a coin, and it was only then that I noticed the tail protruding from the butt of her leotard, part of her fancy dress. The other woman, too, had a tail, sitting erect on the stool behind her. As Lily bent over the jukebox to make her selection, the tail swished slightly in the air. "How do you make it do that?" I asked, coming up behind her. I was feeling slightly drunk from the cocktail and all the raki I'd consumed earlier. The tail was actually flesh-colored, with a fairy collar halfway along its length, and another at the tip, as if the regions between the furred collars had been shaved. I grasped the brown furry tail end, which was still swishing gently as Lily fingered bakelite buttons on the jukebox, and I squeezed the tip hard. It was the wrong thing to do. Lily spun round, slamming into the jukebox.
"Don't do that," she hissed at me. "Don't ever do that."
She was coiled like a spring, her eyes leaking venom. Astonished by this transformation, I mumbled an apology.
"I hate it when men do that."
"Sorry." I looked round for Wheeler and the other woman, but they were gone. So too had the shadowy figure, clearing up the tables behind us. Lily and I were left alone in the bar. "Where did..." There was a few seconds of vinyl hiss before honeyed saxophone music started oozing from the jukebox. Lily's mood was restored, and she sidled up close, enfolding her arms around me.
"Come here. Let's dance. I'm sorry I reacted like that. I'm sensitive. Here, dance a little closer."
The bar dissolved around us. I abandoned myself to Lily's embrace. Her perfume, or maybe it was her natural cassolet, had me inflamed. An hour later she was undressed in my apartment, and I was carefully examining her tail. Her anatomy was normal in every other way. She had the physique of a centerfold, but she also had a tail. This time she let me touch it, but tenderly. She let me stroke it. She let me run my fingers gently along its sinuous curved length. Three collars of brown tail fur had been left unshaved. These were at the tip, the location of my early offense, in the sensitive middle, and at the coccyx, where the tail joined the body at the base of her spine. The exposed, shaved skin was considerably lighter than the rest of her sallow flesh tone. "Why do you shave it?" I asked, as she stood over me naked. I marveled at the way she could make it swish lightly from side to side. She shrugged.
"Fashion."
"Sure," I said. "Doesn't everyone shave their tails these days?"
She grew bored with my fascination for her tale, aggressively straddling me and pinning me back on the bed. For the next hour she rolled over me like a heat wave. Her tongue was rough like a cat's tongue, and the odor of her body was an intoxicant, like the smell of a waterfront spice warehouse in the old trading days of Candia. I abandoned myself to her, and she to me, though all the time I couldn't help wondering how her tail was behaving behind her, or beneath her, or beside her. At the moment of her orgasm, I instinctively reached around and grasped it above her coccyx. She gasped, sinking her nails deep into my back, and tearing lightly at my skin with her sharp teeth. When I woke in the morning, I somehow expected her not to be there, but she was already awake, her head resting on the pillow. She blinked at me sadly. "What is it?" I said, wiping away a tear with my thumb. She wouldn't answer me. She slipped out of the bed, dressed hurriedly, and then kissed me deeply and passionately.
"I've got to go.
When can I see you again? I didn't want to lose her. Will you be at the Shades Club?"
"Sure,"
she said rather cynically.
"When it next opens."
Then she left. I made a shout at her, but there was something stuck to my tongue. I plucked it from my mouth. It was a dark hair. In distaste, I flicked it away. But in that time, Lily had gone. My skin tingled in the places she'd bitten me. I had a high temperature. In the evening, I returned to the Shades Club, only to find it closed. The malfunctioning neon sign had been switched off. I couldn't find anyone around the place to ask when it was going to open again. I scoured the town for signs of Lily, or of Wheeler, or even for the other girl in the bar. Exhausted, I returned to my room, where I fell into a hot, feverish sleep lasting some days. I don't know if this happened to me a year ago, or just the night before last. Time has a way of becoming a concertina, of expanding and diminishing moments in this town. I spend the hours drifting in the streets, returning to the Shades Club of an evening, never to find it open. I ask the waiters at the other bars if they know anything about it. Someone was working there that night I met Lily, but no one seems able to tell me anything. They regard me sadly, pour me a drink. Sometimes they give me a meal. I've made efforts to get out of this town, but every time I resolve to leave, then I'm distracted by another hair on my tongue, or an involuntary twitch of my tail muscle. I don't know when the tail first appeared. I woke up one morning, and it was there, as if it had always been there. I keep it self-consciously coiled inside my trousers as I go about the town, hoping its movements won't betray me. But the discomfort of the tail is nothing compared to the hollow ache, the hunger, the yearning to make one moment snap together with another to form a chain of some consequence, some meaning. For I catch myself, washed up on this street or in that club, with no sense of why I came there or what it is I'm looking for. I am haunted by the desire to know what I am doing in this place. I haven't seen Ben Wheeler since that night. I know he struck some kind of a deal involving me, which helped him get out of town. Meanwhile, I wait. I wait for the Shades Club to open its door again. I wait for an old acquaintance to turn up at one of the waterfront bars, so that maybe this time I can strike the deal. And every now and then, something appears on the tip of my tongue, a hair, a strand of fur, like something half-remembered, or like the first words in a strange, impossible story I'm about to tell. A story about the town of Candia, with its sleepy waterfront, and its lost bars and missing streets, and its ruined temples, dedicated to gods glimpsed only once in a lifetime. A story about Candia, the town that couldn't decide its allegiance between the Greeks and the Turks, and so invited its own downfall. But then a kind of waking sleep washes over me, and I find myself back again, in one of the bars on the waterfront, nursing a glass of raki, while the Resetika man decants from his bursting heart in this town of forgotten miracles.
Mbo, Nicholas Royal.
Nicholas Royal, born in Manchester in 1963, is the author of five novels, including Counterparts, The Director's Cut, and Antwerp, and two novellas, The Appetite and The Enigma of Departure. he has published around 120 short stories, 20 of which are collected in Mortality. Widely published as a journalist with regular appearances in Time Out and The Independent, he has also edited 12 original anthologies, including 2 Darklands volumes and The Tiger Garden, a book of writer's dreams. The winner of 3 British Fantasy Awards, he teaches creative writing at Manchester Metropolitan University. He has a black cat called Max. MBO, one of the more visceral and violent stories in this anthology, is a good example of Royal's talent as crackerjack storyteller and brings together 2 legends. He says, "Islands are interesting precisely because they are isolated. Evolution can follow a different path. The Javan tiger, extinct. The Tasmanian tiger, widely believed to be extinct and actually a marsupial rather than a cat. The Zanzibar leopard, probably extinct, but you never know. The Zanzibar leopard was smaller than its mainland counterpart, and its spots were different too. A search for evidence of the cat's presence on the island in the 1990s uncovered no trace, but it's hard when you stand on the edge of the Jazani forest, gazing in, not to imagine the leopard lurking somewhere within."
Nicholas Royle, born in Manchester in 1963, is the author of 5 novels, including Counterparts, The Director's Cut, and Antwerp, and 2 novellas, The Appetite and The Enigma of Departure. He has published around 120 short stories, 20 of which are collected in Mortality. Widely published as a journalist, with regular appearances in Time Out and The Independent, he has also edited 12 original anthologies, including 2 Darklands volumes and The Tiger Garden, a book of writer's dreams. The winner of 3 British Fantasy Awards, he teaches creative writing at Manchester Metropolitan University. He has a black cat called Max. Mbo, one of the more visceral and violent stories in this anthology, is a good example of Royle's talent as crackerjack storyteller and brings together 2 legends. He says, "Islands are interesting precisely because they are isolated. Evolution can follow a different path. The Javan tiger, extinct. The Tasmanian tiger, widely believed to be extinct and actually a marsupial rather than a cat. The Zanzibar leopard, probably extinct, but you never know. The Zanzibar leopard was smaller than its mainland counterpart, and its spots were different too. A search for evidence of the cat's presence on the island in the 1990s uncovered no trace. But it's hard when you stand on the edge of the Josani forest gazing in, not to imagine the leopard lurking somewhere within. It was a question of arriving at the right time. You didn't necessarily, for example, turn up at the same time each evening, but juggled various considerations, such as the heat, the number of clouds in the sky, even what type they were, whether they were cumulus or stratus or cirrostratus, stuff like that. You wanted to turn up just at the right moment, just in time to get a seat and a good view, and not a moment too soon. After all, the terrace of the Africa House Hotel was not a place you wanted to spend any more time than you absolutely had to. It simply wasn't that nice. It wasn't nice partly because you were surrounded by all those people you had gone to Zanzibar to get away from. White people, Europeans, tourists, Mzungu, the locals called them, red bananas. White inside, but red on the outside, as soon as they'd been in the sun for a couple of hours. Apparently there was a strain of red-skinned banana that grew on the island. And partly because the place itself was Grotsville, In colonial days, the Africa House Hotel was the English club, but since the departure of the British in 1963, it had been pretty much allowed to go to seed. But you didn't go there for the moth-eaten hunting trophies on the walls or the charmless service at the counter, but to sit as close to the front of the terrace as you could, order a beer and have it brought to you, and watch the sun sink into the Indian Ocean. Over there, just below the horizon, the continental landmass of Africa. Amazing, really, that you couldn't see it, thought Craig. It didn't really matter how far away it was, 20 miles, 30. Looking at it on the map, Zanzibar Island was no more than a tick clinging to the giant African elephant. Craig ordered a Castle Lager from the waiter, who slunk oilily around the tables and their scattered chairs. He was a strange, tired-looking North African with one of those elastic snake buckle belts doing the job of keeping his brown trousers up. Similar to the one Craig had worn at school, 8,000 miles away in East London. He didn't like ordering a castle or being seen with one. They didn't give you a glass at the Africa House Hotel. It was South African, and everyone knew it was South African. He supposed it was all right now, but still, if people saw you drinking South African beer, they'd assume you were drinking it because that's what you drank back home, in South Africa. And whereas it was all right to buy South African goods, it still wasn't all right to be South African. And Craig wasn't. And he didn't want anyone to think he was, but not so badly that he'd drink any more of the Tanzanian Safari or the Kenyan Tusker. One was too yeasty, and the other so weak it was like drinking bat's piss. This was his third consecutive evening at the Africa House Hotel, and he was by now prepared to let people think he was, or might be, South African. He wasn't staying there, no way, He was staying at Mazen's, a few minutes' walk away. Aircon, satellite TV, a bath as well as a shower, and a business center. The business center was what had clinched it, plus the fact the paper was paying. Craig slipped the elastic band off his ponytail and shook out his fair hair, brushed it back to round up any strays and reapplied the elastic. He took off his Oakley wraparound shades and pinched the bridge of his nose between thumb and forefinger, stuck them back on, squinted at the sun still a few degrees above the bank of stratus clouds which would prevent the Africa House Hotel crowd from enjoying a proper sunset for the third evening in a row. From behind his Oakleys, Craig checked out the terrace. People watching, with a purpose for once. News of the disappearances clearly wasn't putting these tourists off coming to Zanzibar. Mainly because there wasn't any news. Not enough of a problem in any one country to create a crisis. One weeping family from Sutton Coldfield. Sarah just wouldn't go off with anyone. She's not that kind of girl. A red-eyed single mother from Strathclyde. There's been no word from Louise for 3 weeks now. It wasn't enough to get the tabloids interested, and the broadsheets wouldn't pick up on it until they were sure there was a real story, a big story. No news was no news, and, by and large, didn't make the news. Craig had latched on to Sarah's story following an impassioned letter to the editor of his paper from the missing girl's mother. He was a soft touch, he told his commissioning editor, couldn't bear to think of those good people sitting on the edge of their floral-patterned IKEA sofa waiting for the phone to ring, weeping, especially not in Sutton Coldfield. But McNeil, who'd been commissioning pieces from Craig for 3 years, knew the young man only attached himself to a story if there was a story there. And since he was between desk assignments anyway, McNeil let him go. On the quiet, like. neither the Tanzanian government nor the Zanzibari police would acknowledge the problem. Too damaging to the developing tourism industry, ironically. So Craig needed a cover, which Craig's sister, the wildlife photographer, came up with. The Zanzibar leopard, smaller than the mainland species, was rumored by some to be extinct and by others to be around still, though in very small numbers. One of the guidebooks reckoned if there were any on the islands, they had to be domesticated by practitioners of herbal medicine. Witch doctors to you and me. The Zanzibari driver who collected Craig from the airport laughed indulgently at the idea. And Craig read later in another guidebook that witchcraft was believed to be widely practiced on Pemba Island, 85 kilometers to the north of Zanzibar, though part of the same territory. Though if you tried to speak to the locals about it, they became embarrassed or politely changed the subject. But that was Pemba. And the disappearances, 37 to date, according to Craig's researches, were quite specifically from Zanzibar Island. 37. 23 women between 17 and 30, and 14 men, some of them older, mid-40s. From Denmark, Germany, Austria, Britain, France, Italy, Australia, and the U.S. Enough of a problem as far as Craig was concerned. He was torn now. He was ashamed to admit, between wanting the world to wake up and make a concerted effort, thereby hopefully securing the earlier recovery of Sarah, or Sarah's body, and